Good evening, this is Mae Brussel. The title of this one-hour broadcast is World Watchers. It is program number 791, February the 2nd, 1987. On February the 2nd, 1952, 35 years ago, Otto Albrecht von Bolschwing, the former head of the Romanian Iron Guard, a member of Hitler's Waffen-SS, came to the United States with the assistance of the Vatican. He became an American citizen in 1957. Later, he became president of a technology firm for the Defense Department titled TCI. And then TCI had two subsidiaries in the Silicon Valley area, and one of them was taken over by Albert Hakim. Hakim joined took over the firm, and then was joined by General Richard Secord and Theodore Shackley and Thomas Kleins and Edwin Wilson, and the banks that they use in Switzerland, and the very persons I mentioned are involved with the Iran-Contra gate, and I'll go into more of that in a few minutes. I'm going to be speaking at the University of California in Santa Cruz, February the 18th. That's a week from next Wednesday night at 8 p.m. At first, I was going to speak just to one particular class up there on political science and the double government, the government behind our backs. But the meeting has been changed to Merrill Dining Hall so that the public is invited. This gives me a chance to meet a lot of listeners to World Watchers that I don't meet otherwise and do not know. And it also gives me a chance to be with people I do know and don't see often enough. So I will be up there at 8 o'clock and maybe a few minutes before to visit with you. And certainly afterwards we can visit and get together. So that's at UC Santa Cruz, and that is a week from Wednesday, February the 18th. I noticed in the paper this week that Claus Barbie has been put in the hospital. He's having a little trouble with his urinary tract, of course, trouble urinating. Barbie is the former chief of the Gestapo from Lyon, France. He has been in jail 4 years. I said just from the moment that he was arrested, and a lot of people believed that, he would hardly come to trial. The trial is set for spring, early summer. He's a major connecting link of the cocaine traffic in Bolivia to the cocaine in Brazil, to Joseph Mengele, and to various mafia persons with drug traffic and gun running going from South America to Syria and to Italy and back to the United States. And he's also a link to George Bush and Mr. Rodriguez and the persons funding the Contras from El Salvador with money in the Panamanian and Cayman Island banks. Barbie is crucial to this case, and I've talked about it many times, and we'll have to update some of the stories on Barbie that I did. I've been told and had on the air for years the relationship of the cocaine John DeLorean had, the money that allegedly went to Klaus Barbie and was put in Joseph Mengele's bank account in Zurich, Switzerland. Of course, on the basis of what I was told, I knew at all times DeLorean would get off of any charges that he had in any court, federal or civil, which he did. And Gordon Novell from Permandex, the network that was set up for political assassinations, escorted DeLorean around and accompanied him until he was relieved of all responsibility in two trials. And now DeLorean had just got $20 million from Germany to start a new car company. So Barbie is now hospitalized, and for all purposes, our William Casey, close related to this whole network, is out of the picture and is being replaced. Last week, I mentioned on the air an article by Zbigniew Brzezinski called Southwest Asia, the Next Hotspot. And I also cited how long-term military strategy is set ahead, how a team get together and decide where to go and what to destabilize or conquer or who to kill in the next 20 years. They plan that 20 years in advance. So given all the troubles in the Middle East, Brzezinski is on the team that makes the decisions for the next 20 years. And he announced in Reverend Moon's paper, that the Washington Times, that Southwest Asia would be the next hotspot, that we should take the troops out of NATO and send them down for strategic offensive forces. Well, after I saw that article, a week later, the January 25th, the Los Angeles Times has a long story by their great syndicated columnist Henry Kissinger, former Secretary of State. They refer to him as that, not the National Security Advisor, but Secretary of State, titled Next U.S. Policy for the Pacific. So this LA Times article is syndicated also in major newspapers. So Brzezinski one week is saying now we're going into the Pacific and belongs to this same organization, this secret team that's not so secret these days. At least it's up front and their faces are being photographed and identified as being part of that inner team that make decisions. For 20 years, just the week after I mentioned the one article, I saw the Henry Kissinger article, and he confirms the same thing, only in a lengthy description of why we have to go into the Pacific, as if we didn't have a policy for the Pacific starting before the end of World War II. I also cited January 27th, last Monday, a Wall Street Journal article titled Rifkin Sacked, and that has to do with Jeremy Rifkin, not Simon Rifkin. I'll get to Simon later. They're spelled differently. One has a D. But Jeremy Rifkin, who has been trying to stop the spraying of genetically altered bacteria on food and stop the Ice Minus project because of not knowing the consequences of it. Wall Street Journal editorial, as I say, ran a very gleeful item, Rifkin sacked, the same time that I was told they were prepared to spray out here in Monterey County. And another synchronicity, the Los Angeles Times had an editorial the same day, Rifkin strikes out. And this is about Jeremy Rifkin, who has single-handedly waged war against biotechnology in the courts to block important research and experimentation in genetic engineering. Fortunately, his luck runs out, according to the LA Times, and they cite the judge, Gerard Jessel, in Washington, D.C. And the LA Times says Rifkin had sought to overturn the coordinated framework for regulation of biotechnology that the White House Office of Science and Technology issued last June. Well, the White House Office of Science and Technology, starting in June of 86, I cited, was run, started to be run, and is now by William Graham, who was head of the Challenger, the space program, when the Challenger went down. And Rifkin is trying to fight Graham, who has this ultimate power, working for NASA and working for the White House science, which is exactly where the bottleneck is because they work so closely with members of the board of directors and with the very persons that formed AGS. The LA Times editorial says that the hypothetical issue that Rifkin raises in his suits was thrown out, that the judge says they are not only hypothetical, that there's injury to the workers or people involved, but they are extremely unlikely to occur. Oh, so unlikely that they cannot be the basis for stopping research of potentially great benefit to humanity. By regulating biotechnology, the federal government is taking the appropriate steps needed, and the courts understand that this is specious and harmful for Mr. Rifkin to hold up their experiments. Also this past week, there was an article, Firm Promises Frost Ban Test Safety. They're ready to begin their experiments in San Benito County, the announced experiments, not the secret ones. And they have two parcels of land where it will be conducted, the size of two tennis courts. They'll put the spray of Ice Minus. It'll be sprayed twice by hand during the times when there is little wind. And when the tests were done, the plants will be completely burned so nobody can see what was on those plants or test them anymore to see how harmful they are. Another article from the San Jose Mercury, Frost Ban Turf War Shapes Up. San Benito County may take on the state, and Supervisor Mark R. Graves is fighting this and wants to know the issues involved that determine how much the property owners have, say, over their land as against what is decided by the state officials. Can they decide a long way ago? The People's Daily World has a story this past week, U.S. pesticide poisoning Costa Rica workers. United Nations reported the Costa Rican banana plantation workers said the pesticide made by Dow Chemical, and this is linked to the company of AGS and Roman Haas, and Shell Company have left the workers sterile. There's a court action blaming the chemicals that are put on the bananas for more than 500 men working with standard fruit banana plantations becoming sterile for life as a result of exposure to the pesticide DBCP in the 70s. And the point of this article says that a lot of persons have been inflicted. The figure may be as high as 2,100 that were sterilized, and there's growing concern about many more people. and that a consideration is the long-term risk that the illnesses and cancers don't show up until 15 years after exposure to DBCP. And what I said about AGS is that they did a summer program for 2 months of spraying and said, see, it's safe, and want to produce the genetically altered bacteria on foodstuff now, when the truth is that a lot of poisons and cancers show up 15 years after the original exposure and use of these pesticides. The UN World Health Organization classified DBCP as extremely hazardous. It was linked to sterility in male workers. Dow Chemical stopped it in 1977. Occidental and Shell did also. But another company called AMVAC, AMVAC, took over the production when the others were told it was dangerous and continued to sell it to TNC's Standard Fruit parent company, Castle and Cook, as well as Del Monte and United Brands. And the irreversible sterility occurs 100 hours after exposure, and plantation workers in the banana fields were exposed to more than 4,500 hours use of the pesticide. Many of you might have read about the powdered milk and the problems in Germany, West Germany, of disposing of radioactive cargo. I read today that they're going to bury this cargo, but the point is that the discussion of what to do with this material came out of the North Rhine-Westphalia area, the squabble, and that's the area where an atomic plant was leaking at the same time that Chernobyl was leaking simultaneously out of Germany. There was a plant leaking, and they have a tremendous amount of powdered milk that is poisoned, but they can't say. They're blaming Chernobyl, which is what I knew they would do, and they can't say whether or not it actually came from the plant in Germany. But the point is that they were ready to send the contaminated milk that was radioactive to two countries, one to Egypt and the other to Angola. Now, we know that the Western allies are at war against Angola. The freedom fighters are fighting the communist government in Angola. And it's interesting that the radioactive milk that was produced by cows in Germany, in an area where their own plant was leaking, intended to send it to Egypt and Angola, where there's a tremendous amount of strife and where we've been heavily involved with these countries, first with the coup when Sadat was murdered, and now getting ready to move out Mubarak and put in a stronger military dictatorship, but to feed the people in Egypt and Angola. Those were the areas earmarked. Shows that that contaminated food and radiated food can easily be used as a weapon, so that a good percentage of those in Angola could possibly have cancer, and then make it easier to control them or get rid of them in that particular way, or test the radiated milk on the population and see if it is a way to eliminate them, such as with locusts and droughts and AIDS and so forth. Another article from the London Times called Testing for a Deadly Mold tells about a quarter of the food produced by tropical countries harbors lethal aflatoxin, a chemical secreted by the mold Aspergillus flavus. It grows on peanuts, maize, and wheat, and it is a very dangerous mold. It causes liver cancer, and it could affect the Third World and the West. And the technique of monoclonal antibodies, using the technique of that genetic engineering, the United States and USA developed ways of detecting the toxin in the suspect and the supplies of the food coming in. There are 30 or 40 crops that are imported, and they want to use genetic engineers and tests developed at MIT and Boston University. It'll only detect the problem. It won't help it. And they want to find a way to ensure the famine-hit countries are not inadvertently given toxin-contaminated supplies that in the long run would hurt them. So this is another way in the Third World of making sure of a death if these toxins are administered. And it is linked to testing and genetic sciences without a guarantee that the Third World, again, already identified as being a victim of these diseases, or this particular disease, wouldn't be hit in another way besides all the other things that are hitting them. Another article from the San Jose Mercury this past week, test tells farmers if you have a flu, it's really pesticide poisoning. In Champaign, Illinois, the farmers have flu-like symptoms. They may actually be suffering from the pesticide contamination. And remember, AGS listed Ice Minus as a pesticide, not as a live bacteria, but as a pesticide. And they recall a person, they quoted one man, Don Carey, who felt as if he had the flu. He seemed to be laid up all summer, and it turned out it was pesticide poisoning. And they want to give tests to see whether people are poisoned by the pesticide. And then this article said that very expensive, more expensive, sensitive urine tests in the farm areas in Illinois showed 30% of the farmers had low levels of poisoning. Now, what would the Mexican farm workers working on strawberry fields in California, in the fruits and so forth, get from Ice Minus? The symptoms of the pesticide poisoning in this case are headaches, nausea, dizziness, and fatigue. And the blood test given to farmers is the only way to get the extent of the damage. But how many people can afford that, and how many people can identify the pesticides that are causing their illness? Last week, I also mentioned the global strategists and their plans for how the world should be run for the next 20 years, and mentioned on the board of directors of this group, one of the many working with Fritz Kramer's Fred Eakley and Henry Kissinger and Zbigniew Brzezinski, is W. Graham Clater, Jr. I cited his name on the program number 790 last week. The New York Times has a picture of W. Graham Clater, Jr. He's president of Amtrak Corporation, and he was testifying before the Senate Committee on the Safety or the Possible Drug Usage of Persons Driving, Running, or Engineering his trains that collided January the 4th, 1987. I talked to a couple in New York City, two of my favorite people, long, long world watchers and very close friends, and one of them was on that train, just one car away from where these main accidents took place, or two cars away from that. And as a matter of fact, she was in a direction going up towards the front of the train, and for a particular reason went back, and going back and not passing through the dining car saved her life. And I just learned this last week that one of our best and most loyal and wonderful world watchers is safe and fine. There were 16 that died, 170 were injured. You never get over some of the trauma of being in an accident like that. But the chairman of Amtrak, the head of the train company, W. Graham Clater, is in the company of Brzezinski, Fred Eakley, Daniel Graham's partner, with Fritz Kramer, the Star Wars head of First Strike. I call it the First Strike Star Wars. Daniel Graham shares space with Fritz Kramer, who's on the National Security Council with Fred Eakley, William Clark, Zbigniew Brzezinski. They are making our decisions into the next 20 years, to the year 2001, they say. I also last week gave reference or the title of a new book called The President's Secret Wars, the CIA and Pentagon Covert Operations Since World War II. It is the President's Secret War, and it comes, the decisions come out of the National Security, then to the CIA. And I gave the author John Paredes, and the publisher is Morrow. There's another new book that was described in the Sunday London Times this past week called Armed Truce, The Beginning of the Cold War, 1945-46, by Hugh Thomas. This is published in England by Hamish Hamilton, and this goes into the speech that Winston Churchill gave 40 years ago, in which he proclaimed the Iron Curtain descended on Europe, and this was allegedly the opening up of the Cold War, that famous speech given in Missouri. And Mr. Thomas goes into the fact of Churchill's speech being the official recognition of having what the term, what they called the Cold War, the hot war having stopped in 1945, and then the famous speech with Truman declaring the Cold War against Russia and the Soviet Union. Actually, the Cold War began in 1943 when Martin Bormann and the top Nazis were secret dealing with Alan Dulles and William Donovan of the OSS. And I've cited the book The Last Hero many times. It's about Wild Bill Donovan. And in towards the end of the book, page 795, and that's a lot of pages, it describes in May of 1945 when the war in Europe had been over only a few days, two or three, a small group around William Stevenson of British intelligence formed a company known as British American Canadian Corporation, a New York base registered in Panama. Now, the key point of Panama is that that is the section and banking, as well as Switzerland, for the Otto von Bolschwing Reinhard Galen network, and von Bolschwing and Galen and Donovan and Casey and the whole gang from the OSS that became part of the CIA and also the Waffen-SS that melted into the CIA, their banking department and their offices registered in Panama ever since the end of the war, including the Swiss banks. And that is a very important thing to remember when I get back to Albert Hakim and Stanford Technology and Otto von Bolschwing and the Swiss banks involved in this scandal of the Contra Iran gate. The Panamanian banks are very important. And also they're the connection to Klaus Barbie and cocaine money and drug traffic throughout South and Central America. The book The Last Hero describes how British American Canadian company, the British American Canadian Corporation, changed its name to World Commerce Corporation and still kept its offices and banking in Panama. And this is the group that began the Cold War in 1943, gave it a title by Churchill later in Missouri, but the BAC and the WCC were set up by William Donovan of the OSS, by his law firm of Donovan, Leisure, Newton, Lombard, and Irvine, and the legal advisor was Otto C. During. That's one of Donovan's close associates, and a part of the BACC, and then the other corporation, the WCC, was Nelson Rockefeller with the Chase Manhattan and the Bilderberger, and also John J. McCloy, former Undersecretary of War, who was on the Warren Commission and who took a big part in releasing the top Nazis to become active as part of this corporation after World War II was over. They were locked up in Nuremberg, and John J. McCloy whipped them out of jail to get them set up with headquarters in Madrid and various countries around the world. And the repercussions of all that and the pieces that are coming together now from the Iran-Contra scandal have a lot to do with the Panamanian banks and the network that was set up within days after the war was over. Before I get into those matters and do more on the second half hour on the Iran scandal, and particularly Albert Hakim and Otto von Bolschwing, I do want to update the articles on the Cameroon disaster, because I believe that was a neutron bomb, and every time there is a story updating it, I'm going to keep reminding you of it until we try collectively or individually. I'll write an article on it to expose those people involved with the deaths in Cameroon. The New York Times had a story this past week, cause of Cameroon disaster debated, and it turns out that the American scientists and the British scientists and those involved, the French, of going down to see what went on in Cameroon can't come to a common conclusion. There was a group of scientists in Hawaii that met at a convention, and they couldn't agree. They generally agreed that people were killed by carbon dioxide, but they differ on the cause of the eruption. They differ on the source of the gas. The French said the gas was blown from beneath the lake. The Americans said the gas percolated through the lake floor and accumulated in the lake water. The natural disaster, according to the New York Times, left puzzling clues. All were wiped out. Gas killed people in the villages and littered thousands of decaying cattle. There were no flies swarming around the carcasses. The flies had been killed as well as the birds. The animals were affected by what I said was a neutron bomb. The New York Times reports a meeting, as I say, in Hawaii, of scientists. Some survivors were burned severely and had no recollection of what happened. Others were covered with sores, and the French team said they were acid burns, although nearby trees and bushes blown down had no signs of burns. They said they may have been unconscious for long periods of time, and they even went on to say that they may have fallen over their stoves when they were cooking, and that made them have the burns. Carbon dioxide is invisible and odorless, yet the American team said half of them smelled something, and they smelled rotten eggs. It could be hydrogen sulfide or that of gunpowder, and the physiologist suspected the gunpowder smell was only an illusion based upon effects of carbon dioxide. They had instantaneous unconsciousness of a few people. The inhalation of the carbon dioxide affects the central nervous system. And as I say, they believe maybe they were cooking over their fires. That's like the little girl that was blown or burned with napalm in Southeast Asia. And later the explanation was she caught fire at her hibachi when she was cooking dinner. Another, the French had another clue by the account of one native that the jet of gas was emerging from the lake like fire, and he told of an explosion that lasted 20 minutes and then the waves sloshed up. The gist of this is that it is totally unexplained what happened at Cameroon, and this is a long time later. The New York Times article cited, the one printed actually in the New York Times, said U.S. and French experts differ on the gas eruption. The San Jose Mercury had a reprint and said the cause of the disaster is debated. Either way, the title reads, the headline, nobody can agree on what happened. Another description, the LA Times, is titled, 1,700 in West Africa killed by poison gas, scientists conclude. And then this article goes on again about the disagreements and the inability to come to a conclusion. They said there was no evidence of a major disturbance at the bottom of the lake. So some thought that the flash of light they saw, the explosion they heard, had to be a gas released from the lake, and yet there was no evidence it happened that way. And it, the whole story of what happened in Cameroon is as jumbled as it was when I shared it with you on the air as it was happening. And also, at the same time, the mystery of the Israeli scientists who talked about Cameroon continues to be a source of information investigation in areas such as in the Soviet Union, in the establishment press, in Liberty Lobby. There's a range from the right, left, and middle asking about Mr. Vanenu. The Washington Post said December 26th they denied infringing on his rights. The Guardian had an article January 27th that Vanenu confirmed that Israel had material and technology to produce the neutron bomb, a sophisticated weapon that can kill an entire population, leaving buildings intact. There is a group or contribution fund for legal help for Mordecai Vanenu, and you may want to write to them and ask about the thought of his exposing the neutron bomb being the reason that he's locked up so tightly in Israel. You can write to P.O. Box 45005, Somersville, Massachusetts, 02145. And the title of the article is Israel's Atomic Traitor, Tel Aviv Tries to Silence a Dangerous Critic. And it goes into what he revealed about Israel's atomic weapons, but it also, the same article, said that he confirmed that Israel had the neutron bomb. Alex Coburn wrote for In These Times about Vanenu and the way he secreted in Israel and the atomic bomb, but Alex Coburn has not caught on yet to the fact that the reason that the Israeli Mossad kidnapped Vanenu, and he writes about that, is that he revealed the neutron bomb, and that Israel and Shimon Peres and John Singlaub and Alexander Haig and William Colby were all involved with the president of Cameroon in testing that bomb. The People's World has a story, Vanenu detention protested, and throughout the world, the far right and the far left and even the middle are objecting to the silence and the treatment of Mordecai Vanenu. The San Francisco Examiner, January 18th, has an article on John Singlaub titled, Singlaub Faces Major Scrutiny. And in there it says, since his public denunciation of President Carter's policies on troop strength in Korea, the neutron bomb, and the Panama Canal, the result now, stir of the general, made him a hero among the wealthy ultra-conservatives. And this article I cited once before mentions the neutron bomb. Another article from the London Times, January the 4th, the Italians hunt Vanenu woman. A woman named Cindy, a blonde American, met Vanenu in London. She left a message at the hotel for him. He went with her to Italy, and Shimon Peres, the former prime minister of Israel, is trying to say that all of this is an effort to embarrass Mrs. Thatcher because Vanenu was picked up in London. And it had nothing to do with London, but Vanenu left London and went into a car, hired a car, and went to the airport and was accompanied by an American woman by the name of Cindy, who obviously worked for the CIA and the Mossad. Another article last week, Iran says a cloud of gas is killing the Iraqis. Now, are there poison gases that are being put into shells along with chemical weapons? Iran said Wednesday it shelled an Iraqi chemical weapons depot and that a cloud of gas came up and that Iraq is getting the technology for chemical weapons. And Victor Marchetti wrote in Liberty Lobby about Mordecai Vanhanu, that was in the last issue of Liberty and Lobby, and how he revealed this, the capability of Israel for the atomic bombs and where the plutonium was coming and the location of them in the Negev Desert. But also, in this particular article, he does not mention and leaves out the fact that Vanhanu talked about Israel and the neutron bomb. And the latest I've heard of Vanhanu was from New York Times, January 28th. Israeli nuclear worker stays on hunger strike. The jailed nuclear technician accused of passing atomic secrets to a London newspaper refused to end his hunger strike. I don't know if he did it voluntarily or they're starving him off, but he is not eating. I hope he starts eating and lives long enough for a combined group of people to find out what happened in Cameroon if in fact, the Israeli government, along with the United States and the French, and the Cameroon president, of course, were testing their wonderful neutron bomb. I'll take a one-minute break now and go into Iran-Contragate, Albert Hakim, and Stanford Technology.